Karen, you ready?
Good morning. I'd like to call the House Committee on Veterans Affairs to order. Today is Tuesday, beautiful March the 1st day of 2005, and I'd like to honor any veterans who are here today, and if you would stand or raise your hand and let us recognize you.
Sure.
We're most grateful for your service to our nation, for our nation, and for us, for freedom. Today we're honored to have Mr. Bill Olson, who is with the Oregon Brain Injury Association, with us. And would you come forward, please, Mr. Olson, himself a veteran. And we're going to learn more about brain injuries and veterans. And thank you so much for being here. Thank you for the excellent information also that you previously provided the Department of Human Services, or the committee, and they forwarded it to us, and it certainly let us know that we ought to know a little bit. We never could know as much as you do, but we appreciate the knowledge.
Yes, thank you, Chair Nelson, members of the committee. My name is Bill Olson. I'm a volunteer, the advocacy chair for the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. My expertise really is as a father of a young man who's not as young as he was any longer with a brain injury. He suffered while skiing in Mammoth, California, a number of years ago, about 20 years ago now, or a little over. But the reason that I'm here this morning, I guess, number one, is to say the Brain Injury Association wants to help returning veterans with a disability, a brain injury, which is our area. And that's the main message. We want to be a part of the solution, part of the system or the network that's going to reach out to these people as they come home and try to regain their lives. And to share with you some information that I've been able to pull together so that we might get some feeling for the issues that will be faced by some of these veterans. But I want to tell you, number one, I had hoped to be able to give you a profile of the returning veterans in terms of the disabilities that we're seeing from the wounds, in terms of the people coming to Oregon. And I haven't been able to obtain those data. And in fact, I gave some of you in meetings verbal data about the number in the pipeline that might have a traumatic brain injury. And I called Palo Alto yesterday to verify some of that information, and I find that it's not correct. So I'm going to keep pursuing the numbers until I get something that I'm comfortable sharing with the committee. So I just wanted to correct any impression I might have left there in terms of specific numbers of folks coming back with a brain injury. All right, back then to my presentation. Just very briefly, the mission of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon is to improve the quality of life of persons with brain injury and their families, and to prevent brain injury, major objective, of course. Just going through the information that I've been able to gather off the internet, news items, etc. First of all, a fact, more veterans are surviving the wounds that they have suffered or obtained in the war. In Vietnam, for example, 24% of those wounded in action died. At present time, it's down, I think, to about 13%, the numbers I have seen. I've seen other numbers that say 10%, but 13% seems safe. So we're seeing improvements in medical care response to the injuries on the battlefield, evacuation, early treatment. All of those things are saving lives. By the same token, some of these are very severe wounds that people have suffered, multiple amputees plus brain injury, a combination of things. And so we're going to have some folks that really face some significant challenges in recovery. The other information that we have is that this conflict does seem to have a higher percentage of survivors with a traumatic brain injury than other conflicts. And again, some of that may be due to the fact that folks died in previous conflicts with similar injuries. It's also the nature of the explosive devices that are being used. People are being thrown. They're being shaken about, perhaps more than in earlier conflicts, whereas bullet wounds are not really much of a factor. People are well protected, apparently, except for their extremities, including the head. In many cases, traumatic brain injury is difficult to diagnose. And so I will say, without fear of being wrong here, that there will be more traumatic brain injury consequences. There will be ongoing long-term disabilities from brain injury that is greater, the numbers will be greater than what you see and that are diagnosed early on as having a traumatic brain injury. Some of these things show up only when the people go home. In the packet, you have a story of an Oregon family from Seaside in which the other injuries, the broken bones, etc., were apparently the dominant thing. And then when this gentleman returned home, his wife noticed his behavior and other factors, and suddenly he's going back to the rehab center to receive treatment for the brain injury. So this is going to happen. There's this brain injury is a spectrum from very severe and obvious injury to the brain to what is termed mild or subtle brain injury, but it can be subtle to the point where it affects somebody's occupation, their ability to do their job. Fatigue, concentration is not there as it was, and just recognize that there will be more cases of traumatic brain injury and disability from it, or at least deficits from those injuries, than will show up in the early statistics. The long-term...
Excuse me, I just want to... pardon me, Freedom Rose, I want to be sure that the committee members are aware there's a document headed Brain Injury Association of Oregon. Be sure you have it. Not that one. There is another one.
It should be under your... Is your agenda around?
Yes, it's right here.
It's not under...
Sorry, just one moment, please. I know we have an excellent committee, and they love to take notes, so I want to be sure that they have this information.
And it's not this one?
Yes, that's it.
Oh, it is this one.
That is that. That is the one. Okay, so now, does everyone have one? Okay, good. Mr. Olson, you know, having been in aviation as was Representative Boquist, what we found in Vietnam, you know, was this that special hour, the golden hour, that found that if you could, now I don't know what it is now, but then it was if you could immediately transport an individual with traumatic injuries, you know, to a trauma center, the odds went from 19 to 1 to 82, I think, or something like that, to 1, that you could save their lives. Mm-hmm. And I think I always want to give our Vietnam veterans a credit for that, you know, tremendous learning experience we went through. And then in, you know, life flight programs at hospitals, that's exactly what, you know, they're based on today around the nation. So I'm wondering, that might be another reason that we do have more survivors today, is because of the immediate transport that possibly wasn't there in earlier wars. I want to give those credit. Those helicopters seem to make a tremendous difference.
Yes, Chair Nelson, thank you. I think that is amply borne out by the information you'll see in that big packet, that 50-some page packet, that they credit that kind of rapid response and early treatment with saving many, many lives.
Good. Yeah. Okay, please continue now. We're with you.
Well, I just wanted to point out that, again, the long-term consequences of a brain injury are experienced by families as well as by the person that's injured. And it becomes a family experience and a family burden in many, many cases. And so I just want to emphasize the importance, and we can hopefully together talk to the Veterans Administration, and I'm sure they recognize this, the importance of providing support and counsel to families. And indeed, I know that they are being counseled, at least down at Palo Alto, to seek that counseling so that the family's prepared when the person returns. They'll understand if the person is slower in responding, if they're irritable, if they get angry, or their behavior is a little different. They'll at least understand what's causing it, that it's not just willful behavior. And finally, a point that I'm sure we must agree on is that the financial burden of caring for these wounded that are returning and those that will have perhaps and unfortunately a long-term disability, perhaps a lifelong need for care and support, that financial burden should rightly be borne by the federal government in the case of the veterans that are returning from the conflict. And other than advocacy on that score doing what I think the committee has been working on, which is to ensure that the veterans are being counseled as they return and that they're being able to apply for all the benefits that are appropriate in their situation. No other easy answer on that, but we would be happy to support your efforts in that area. The attachments to the testimony include the headlines. The first page is just the headlines from that 50-some page packet. And on the reverse side, I just pulled out some quotations that might be of interest just to give a flavor for some of the material. The second attachment provides statistics on traumatic brain injury in the United States as a whole, and then data that we had from the Health Department for Oregon, so that you get some context in terms of numbers of people. For example, nationally, it's estimated that about 1.4 million people a year experience a traumatic brain injury. That's the whole spectrum, and recognize that it can concussion is a brain injury, so that we're not saying that all of these people have a long-term disability. About 80,000 people a year will experience, nationally will experience, a long-term disability from traumatic brain injury. I should add here that in the last attachment, there's a definition of traumatic brain injury versus acquired brain injury. Acquired is a broader term that would include brain injuries that might have occurred as a result of poisoning, anoxia, stroke. So, I mean, we have people in support groups in which we have stroke survivors and traumatic brain injury survivors. They share very much the same issues. So it seems to work well. As far as we're concerned, we serve anybody with a brain injury. The reason you see data that says traumatic brain injury is because that's what CDC counts. And I believe also it springs from the fact that traumatic brain injuries are considered preventable to perhaps even a greater degree than stroke and other causes, because you've got automobile accidents as a major cause. You have falls. You can wear helmets and prevent or reduce the incidence and severity of the brain injury, etc. So I think that focus on prevention is why we look at traumatic brain injury, as well as the fact that it is coded in hospital records so that you can pull those data. In Oregon, coming back to Oregon just briefly, the overall hospitalization for traumatic brain injury runs from about 2,500 to 3,000 a year. It varies from year to year. Of that number, we don't have a precise number of those people who are suffer a long-term disability. CDC at one point interpolating from data that they have from other states, estimated for a particular year that about 1,200 in Oregon would have had a long-term disability as a result of their hospitalization for TBI. I then therefore just said a third is probably a fairly safe estimate. Recognize also that people that go to the emergency room and are never admitted to the hospital sometimes suffer a long-term deficit from that injury. So it's not really diagnosed, but they have problems. I was at a meeting once where a lady who had been in the Peace Corps 22 years ago in Africa had problems all these years and finally was diagnosed as having had a brain injury. So it doesn't appear immediately. And that's, I guess, another point I want to make is that the system should provide for ongoing assessment because problems will occur beyond any short-term window. And I'm not saying that that isn't a provision now of the service system for veterans, but because I'm not expert on the VA system and data, I realize how much I don't know as I came here to testify today. But that's, I think, an important point, is that we have to be open to the fact that these problems may appear over a period of time. In the third attachment, which is a fact sheet that the Brain Injury Association of America puts out, on the back page of that, you've got a summary of the consequences of brain injury, which have been classified for convenience as cognitive, physical, and emotional. Behavioral, some people use. And I note, I believe in my remarks, that of those categories, the emotional behavioral are by far, in my judgment, the most difficult to deal with and pose the most problems, especially for families, for example. Trying to keep the family unit together when one of the partners has changed as a result of a brain injury is a huge challenge. I think, again, I just want to say that we as an association would like to be a part of the solution, part of the system of care and response when these veterans return, those that do have a traumatic brain injury, and I'd be happy and delighted to try to respond to any questions you have or to get the information if I don't have an answer. Thank you again.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Olson. I just think this is incredible that you have taken this on yourself and so diligently, and want you to know we're greatly concerned for your son, and hopefully we learn something out of these situations in life. Would you mind to just let us understand what the association is made of? Who is the part of this association? We like it to be a part of our VetNet, we call it.
Right. The association was established in 1985 by survivors, family members of survivors primarily, and service providers, people that were serving people with traumatic brain injury and brain injury generally, and just realized that there was a great need to come together to try to provide more resources, more information. We've been in existence then for 20 years as a state association. There was also a predecessor group, the Brain Injury Support Group of Portland, that formed in 1978. And a couple of years ago, the two nonprofits merged for purposes of efficiencies and sharing space, et cetera, that kind of thing. So we merged, and there is a single organization now called the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. At any one time, we probably have on the order of 600 paid members of the association, and many more on the mailing list, of course. our activities are, the number one activity is to be there when somebody calls and needs information. So the information line, we used to call it referral, information and referral, but referral to some people implies a professional level of competence in making the referral, and so we don't use that anymore. Information and resource coordination probably is a better description of what we're trying to do there. We do have an 800 number, and I don't have any data for you exactly, but we do field a number of calls from survivors, family members, and service providers. We put on an annual conference and other educational conferences or meetings during the year. We have a quarterly newsletter. Maintain or coordinate a network of support groups throughout the state. But I want to clarify that we don't control all these support groups. Many of them sprung up. And we network with them, try to provide them information and support and encouragement. And so many organizations are cooperating. For example, the independent living centers have been a good resource for us in that regard. And that's one of the reasons you'll see us here advocating for continued funding for the independent living centers around the state.
Would your organization have lists of medical professionals who you recommend or whom you recommend to assist individuals?
Yes, we do. We actually have, along with an organization called Teaching Research, which is based out of Monmouth, Western Oregon University, have established a Oregon Brain Injury Resource Network. It's actually an online resource. We have, you can search by, whether it's medical or by keyword, and it might be a medical person, it might be a psychologist, case management, other services. We would greatly like to build that resource and have more providers out there who are specializing in brain injury. So we're anxious to add to it.
Well, as we've had various individuals from the VA hospital, I owe a dollar already today. I used an acronym, and we're not allowed to use acronyms here, so I did it. So we contribute to the Veterans Fund, so I want everybody to know I realize I did that. We've had various members of the insurance industry with us, and one of the biggest concerns has been mental health parity in our benefit plans. Last week we had Dr. Berger with the Federal Health Division of the Veterans Administration. We were told at that time that without a doubt this medical service would be covered for our veterans. We really want that to happen. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you have individuals who are specialists who would be able to help individuals work through the paperwork, you know, that is part of the medical benefits of all these different veterans or military services, to help them find that mental health parity.
Well, Chair Nelson.
That's okay.
Members of the committee. We probably would not hold ourselves out to help them with the paperwork because we don't have expertise in that area, and I think there are other people that probably do, or at least we're trying to get those resources in the county service officers. And, of course, mental health is not, again, our area, although we do have cases of dual diagnosis, people with both a mental health and a traumatic brain or a brain injury, so that it's not foreign to us. But frankly, I've been looking at that equity issue and recognizing that cognitive rehabilitation is not provided by most insurance companies or most insurance plans. There have been a couple of states. Texas is one, and I'm not sure if Hawaii's gotten there yet. Texas did pass a law requiring insurers to offer cognitive rehabilitation to people with traumatic brain injury. I can't tell you how that's working. I haven't seen an evaluation of how that's working or what difference it's really made. But right now, the insurance companies, for the most part, have taken the position that cognitive rehabilitation is not proven. The studies aren't definitive enough for the insurers. We, of course, take some issue with that and say that this is an important service that is not being experienced by most people. However, I believe the Veterans Administration is at least they're studying it on an experimental basis or on an evaluation basis. I can't give you the details on that, but they have a program going where they've been looking at people actually over a period of years to see which approach to rehabilitation or cognitive rehabilitation for folks with traumatic brain injury is most effective. And it would be helpful if I had better information on the results of that study, and I intend to get them.
Well, we would appreciate whatever information you get. We'd appreciate your sharing it with us, and it would help greatly. Are there other questions? Representative Farr.
Chair Nelson, I just wanted to make this comment for the record. I think that mental health parity would probably apply more to combat stress, psychological disorders versus a traumatic brain injury, which could result in the same things but would actually be caused by a blow to the head, an injury to the brain from externally, versus, you know, trauma that's experienced because of the stress of combat or, you know, because of something that has happened during the crisis. Is that the way you would understand it?
Yes, Chair Nelson, Representative Farr. That is the way I understand it. And I think there's some gray area there because the symptoms are very similar for example, post-traumatic stress disorder and brain injury.
But generally, a brain injury can be detected with an MRI or another type of test that can actually show that there was a blow to the skull.
Well, I'm not a medical person. I'm the father of some of the brain injury. But I believe that many brain injuries do not yield evidence through a scan. You have these tiny synapses that get shaken around and pulled apart, and they don't necessarily show up as a lesion in the brain. Certainly some scans will show a lesion if there's one there. They can be helpful, but they're not definitive. But again, that's what makes it difficult for some people to convince the authorities or whoever that they have a brain injury and they're not just malingering. And it's a real challenge for folks sometimes who are accused of not wanting to work, you're not trying, etc.
And I also, for the record, want to note that I said MRI, but I can't. I had to use that acronym because I don't know what MRI is.
Magnetic resonance
imaging.
Okay. But that's, we'll accept your money. We appreciate your honesty, Representative
Barnhart. Well, Bill said he'll pay for me.
Oh, well, that's nice. Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two kinds of questions. Questions, I guess. The first one is, would you define a bit what you that term cognitive rehabilitation as you're using it or as you've been using it this morning? And I think I know what you're talking about, but I'm not certain that I've got the right firewalls on it.
Mm-hmm. Chair Nelson, Representative Barnhart, I don't have a technical definition of cognitive rehabilitation myself.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking about when I talk about cognitive rehabilitation is working with people to, in effect, reprogram them in certain areas where they have difficulty. For example, short-term memory loss is a real issue or problem with many survivors of brain injury. And it's not something that you necessarily are going to repair. Repetition can help get that information in and allow people to retrieve it, for example. But just as likely, the rehabilitation in this sense is going to mean working with people to develop coping techniques and drilling them in those and making those a part of their lives. We all use daytimers, but a person with a traumatic brain injury and a memory problem needs to use the daytimer as part of their anatomy, practically, in order to organize and get on with their lives. They need all kinds of adaptive things, such as putting notes on the door before you go out, reminding you of things. But when it comes to actual remediation in the brain itself, I'm in a little bit over my head there. So.
Thank you. If I may, my second topic, if
Please.
I may. Thank you, Madam Chair. The materials that you provided, I find fascinating and very interesting. And I note the very first article in the packet that you give called Brain Injuries High Among Iraq Casualties by Chuck Wagner talks about helmets and the possibility that the kinds of helmets that are currently being used in Iraq may actually be contributing to some extent to this problem. It also notes in the article that there's something called a modular integrated communications helmet, which they're experimenting with now to determine whether that would work better. Do you have any additional information about this equipment issue as it relates to traumatic brain injury or the possibility of preventing it?
Chair Nelson, Representative Barnhart, no, I haven't any more definitive information on equipment and how it might prevent brain injury. I've seen the same article you have, is that they're working on a helmet. They're trying to look at the design of the helmet to see if they might find something that would be more effective in preventing or mitigating the injury, an injury.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, if I may, I might note that part of my work as a psychologist was to do neuropsychological evaluations. I'm very familiar with the issues that the witness is talking about. And I can say that often it is not possible to tell why a person has difficulties or disabilities without doing a neuropsychological evaluation. The equipment that is available to image the brain simply isn't detailed enough to give you the kind of information in the case of so-called mild brain injury. But mild brain injuries may have huge impacts on what people are actually capable of doing. What the neuropsychologist does is look at subtle signs of disability that tend to correlate or constellate around certain kinds of brain injury. Someone who demonstrates memory problems may also have other subtle difficulties that you're not going to see unless you study them very, very carefully. When you're dealing, and of course a neuropsychological evaluation is an expensive proposition because you're talking about a number of hours of highly trained professionals' time and some fairly subtle, usually cognitive tests that have to be done, usually over a period of at least a day. So this is not the sort of thing that you engage in lightly or without a very good reason. And the result is that there are probably lots of people out in the world who look like they're malingering, who look like they have personality disorders or other kinds of things that make it difficult for them to work or relate with their families and so forth, who in fact have suffered traumatic brain injuries. I really appreciate Mr. Olson, you're bringing this to the attention of the committee. I have to admit that with my background, it hadn't occurred to me that this would be the fact that brain injury as an increased result of combat would be one of the effects of the war, and I appreciate your bringing that information to us.
I also I think it's very important. On page 4, where talked about Walter Reed Center seeking out possible brain injury casualties instead of waiting for referred patients. And I want to bring that one to the attention of the committee, because one of our major pieces of legislation is asking for some bridge funds to allow our soldiers to be assessed. And I think that's just one more reason why what we've proposed here at the legislature is right. You know, seeking it out, seeking this information rather than just waiting, you know, for the emotional or depressive reactions or symptoms. I think it's far more important if we're truly concerned about these veterans than we are. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I mean, I'd like to thank Mr. Olson for his testimony. And they did, his association came to my office and actually went into some of this in detail before and actually encouraged him to bring it forth. A quick answer before my question to Representative Barnhart's modular integrated communications helmet question. Special operations in Iraq bought and fielded that particular product itself. The number that it has about a 40% improvement is probably accurate. Our own doctors and psychologists, who was a lieutenant colonel, a very senior psychologist, basically in the end state said, get rid of the Kevlar and use this. And so we spent a considerable amount of our money fielding that for our personnel. The only problem with that helmet is that it doesn't quite provide lower protection around the back of the neck. But a lot of the injuries that we're sustaining out there, which is going to lead into my next question, are not so much injuries of walking into ambushes, but frankly head injuries of beating your head against something as your vehicle goes back and forth like this, or you're chasing somebody down an alleyway and you slip and hit your head and so on and so forth like that. But that leads me to my question for Mr. Olson, you know, and I know it's not in his purview, I guess, but he has done an extensive amount of research. On the flip page, right inside the table of contents, it does point out that the hostile casualty for Americans is over 1,400 in Iraq, and the inaction wounded is over 10,000 in Iraq. My personal experience over the years, and in fact in the seven to 8 months over there, is that in addition to that 10,500 wounded, there would be almost an equal amount that were injured, seriously injured, in non-combat actions in Iraq. Meaning that number would be about, theoretically, 20,000. However, that number is one of the best-kept secrets of the Pentagon. And my question, there are no secrets in the Pentagon, too, is that if Mr. Olson has had some experience or seeing some number that would give us a feel for what is the total combat, non-combat casualty count we're talking about, and the total wounded or injured in action above that 10,000 figure that we could get a grasp of that would allow us to say what is 13% of what number? Do you follow what I'm
saying? Yes, and I've been looking to try to find definitive information, and I came up short because I find that I really need to call Washington, D.C. and do my best there before I come up with too much. But I did find on an Army medicine webpage as of through January 31st, and I'm sorry, I protocol. I missed
that's
you.
That's all right. Go
Chair
ahead.
Nelson, Representative Boquist. I did find the total number of evacuations to Army facilities was cited as 16,723. And that's just the Army now. And of that number, wounded in action, 2,201. Non-battle injuries, 4,998. And disease is a much bigger number. It's 9,500, and so disease would. I don't think that would be wounded, would it?
Could you say again to get those numbers?
Yes, and I'm sorry I didn't include them, but wounded in action 2,201, non-battle injuries 4,998. And disease making up the rest of that 16,000 was 9,524. And I don't have a further breakdown of disease. I frankly, I was pulling this together last night.
No, I appreciate that, though. We, yeah.
We have that's a whole new area.
That's a whole new one, and I guess we'll find someone to help us on that. And we now we're into the types of diseases, and we need to get medical help back. And we really appreciate this.
Just to share one other data source that I ran across for Oregon, the only thing I really show for Oregon, wounded in action, 157 actual. And an estimated additional number of 45, so that would make 202 total wounded, or estimated and actual. They also provide data for those that have died, 21 and 6. H and NH, and it's hostile and non-hostile. We break it into two categories.
Is that Army?
No, that's for all. That's for all services, I believe. It's a different data source. Again, I'm not totally comfortable with any of these numbers, and I don't know that I ever will find the right source, but I'm going to try because I think it's important to know the profile of the service people that are returning to the state in terms of what are the categories of injury and disability that we need to be prepared for and support. So I know we'll get that sooner or later, but it would be nice to kind of get a feeling for it right now.
Yes, we agree with you, and contact might be Dr. Lewis Berger at the federal VA here in our region. I think called it Region 20, and we can get you that information. He reported when he was here, of course, we've had over 1 million military demobed in the United States, or mobbed in the United States. Of those, about 257,000 are from the Northwest. Of those, 10,000 from Oregon. And of those, 200, over 200 have suffered catastrophic amputations of some sort. And another 30 have been blinded. Now, that's as much information as we have current. But it does point out the critical needs. We did not address disease. We did not address particularly non-battle injuries. I wonder, has your group been involved with White City and Roseburg? And Roseburg and its referral system, it's a federal VA program, and White City, that's supposed to be an incredible rehab facility. We plan to visit. I've not visited yet.
Chair Nelson, our connection with the Roseburg facility was that at one point they had a brain injury support group there at the VA center, and we're still in touch with the individual that was facilitating that group, but that group is no longer active.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that really is probably the extent of our involvement there. I intend that our involvement or our connections with the veterans facilities be greatly enhanced.
Yes, I can see it would be great for us all to get together. Any other questions of Mr. Olson? Well, we are so grateful for your coming. We're so grateful for this information, and we certainly want to continue to have you part of the VetNet for this state. We're so grateful to all these 600 plus members and who are greatly concerned about individuals suffering from brain injury and also war accidents and incidents and disease, and we just thank you so much, and we would appreciate any new information you find out sharing with us, and we'll do the same.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify today? Okay. Thank you. If not, I will close our informational meeting, and I will now open the work session.
Yes, Madam Chair, we are almost ready on these legislative drafts. I have three copies of each if anyone wants to see them. I have a list of the legislative drafts for your consideration this morning, and I'll distribute them. If you don't mind, I just handing them out in this fashion. There are 21 of them. They're all called for bills except for one that you'll see on the second page. These are in numerical order. Legislative draft number 3423 on the second page would be a joint memorial. These all relate to veterans, and if there are any members who would like to see them, if you don't mind my fumbling through to get copies, I can do that. On the chart here, I've shown the title, the relating to clause, and the catch line.
We'd like to ask you to go through each one, if you would, please, and if the members would like information on that draft at that time, we'll do so.
Would you like me to read the title as well as the catch line?
I would, please.
All right. The first one is LC 3019. It relates to active members of the military. It would create an Oregon Military Transition Assistance Program. Draft number 3020 relates to state financial administration. It would appropriate money from the general fund to the Oregon Department of Administrative Services for Travel Information Council to repair Camp Adair historical markers. Legislative draft number 3034, relating to property tax exemptions for veterans, would increase the exemption amount and maximum income threshold for veteran homestead property tax exemptions. LC 3043 is relating to higher education, and it would direct post-secondary education institutions to award credit for education and training obtained while serving in the armed forces of the United States. Legislative draft 3044, relating to the Oregon National Guard Health Insurance Task Force, would create an Oregon National Guard Health Insurance Task Force. Legislative draft number 3190, temporary housing for veterans, would require the Director of Veterans Affairs to establish a program to provide grants to veterans for temporary housing. Legislative draft number 3192, relating to veterans, would create a veterans family caregiver program to provide income to family members who provide in-home care to disabled veterans. Legislative draft number 3193, relating to notices provided by long-term care facilities, would require notices by long-term care facilities before or at the time of admission to include information specific to payment of facility charges by veterans. Legislative draft number 3196, relating to annual report by Director of Department of Veterans Affairs, would modify the content of the annual report submitted to the Legislative Assembly or the Emergency Board by the Director of Veterans Affairs. Legislative draft 3222, relating to high school diplomas for veterans, would permit school districts to issue high school diplomas to members of the armed forces who served in Vietnam if the member meets certain requirements. Number 3231, related to veterans, creates a veterans discharge stipend program to provide temporary income to veterans when discharged from active federal service. Legislative draft 3395, relating to charitable checkoff, would require that Oregon Veterans Home be permanently listed on individual tax returns for charitable contribution purposes. Legislative draft 3398, relating to taxation, permits a veteran who is eligible for veterans homestead property tax partial exemption and who is at least 70% disabled to defer property taxes on portion of homestead that is non-exempt. Legislative draft number 3402, relating to active members of the military, would create an Oregon Military Child Care Grant Program. Legislative draft 3403, relating to interest on delinquent taxes, limits the interest that may be charged on delinquent property taxes to imposed on property of members of organized militia called into active service. Legislative draft 3405, relating to referral of unemployment insurance recipients to Jobs Plus program jobs, would require the Employment Department to refer unemployment insurance recipients who are spouses or dependents of individuals deployed on active military duty to the Jobs Plus program job before, referring other unemployment insurance recipients to those jobs. On the second page, there are five more. Legislative draft 3420 relating to veterans would require a waiver of occupational and professional licenses, certificates, permits, and registration fees for veterans. Legislative draft 3422 relating to the Oregon Veterans Support Task Force creates the Veterans Support Task Force. Number 3423 is the joint memorial that we talked about. Does not have a relating clause, but in its current form urges Congress to pass the National Guard and Reserve Bill of Rights Act of 2005. Legislative draft 3428 relating to the Oregon Veterans Affairs Commission abolishes the advisory committee to the Director of Veterans Affairs and establishes an Oregon Veterans Affairs Commission in its place. The last one is draft 3436 relating to higher education tuition. It directs post-secondary institutions to grant veterans and surviving family members tuition waiver.
Thank you very much, Jim. Are there questions regarding any of these legislative drafts? Have been I was unable to keep track of the number of times that our good administrator said LC. I'm sure it was at least $5 worth. But I did notice he corrected it about down at legislative draft number 3398.
And an LC is a legislative draft, but does LC just stand for legislative council number? I'm not sure what LC even stands for, so maybe I owe double because at least we know what VA stands for.
Well, I probably is double. We'll just, since we don't know, we'll accept double. Okay, are there any questions, Representative Boquist, about any of these issues?
Yes, Madam Chair, not a specific one because I think several of these relate to each other. I'm just wondering if under your good guidance, the administrator at some future point may be able to divide up all of the LCs and proposed bills we have into related categories and then further divide it up into those that have a ways and means revenue impact. I believe that's more than $50,000. And those that have less, so that we, for the ease of the committee to start figuring out priorities and how we proceed, that we might know what's going to cost money, what's not going to cost money, and what are the categories. Because I do note that several of these, two of the LCs mentions are very, very similar and probably, I don't know if gut stuff's the right word, but could be amended and merged together at some future point, Madam Chair.
Thank you for that good advice. Are there any other issues? If not, I would at this time consider a motion to accept these as committee bills. Representative Barnes.
Madam Chair, I would move that the Legislative Council drafts on the memo before us be accepted as committee bills.
Okay, is there any objection? Could we have a vote? A roll call? Is it necessary?
Madam Chair, it's not necessary.
Oh, good. Okay, in that case.
We will show anyone who wishes to state their objection, we'll show them as voting no in a roll call vote. So if someone reads the minutes, it'll look like there was a roll call vote.
All right. And I also, at this time, want to express my deepest sympathy to Representative Cobb, who is out today with a severe back injury, apparently, and wish her the best. I know she wished she could have been here. All right. In that case, we will accept all of these legislative drafts as committee measures, and we will sort them according to Representative Boquist's suggestion. And I thank you all for your support of our veterans. When you look at these items, I can't help but think, I mean, isn't it neat that we are securing their future to some degree? It's not extensive. I mean, there's nothing that we've done to date that's, you know, required even $5 million. And when I think of us operating with a $36 billion budget, I think how little, you know, we've done for our veterans. So everything we can do to assist them in retransitioning and also continue to encourage recruitment in our military, who's done such a distinguished job protecting us and freedom. I think it's great. So I thank you, and we will accept these bills. And at this time, we'll adjourn the work session. And if there's no further business, we'll adjourn this meeting. Thank you.